Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the price of progress? While we get almost daily reports lately of China's Herculean effort to whip Beijing's infrastructure into shape for the Summer Olympics, we don't hear as much about the streets and homes and gathering places that have been sacrificed to make room for all that new construction. But while some celebrate the razing of Beijing's dilapidated Hutong neighborhoods, my guest today would caution that when you destroy the places people have lived for centuries, you also destroy the way they have lived. Michael Meyer is a journalist and a former Peace Corps volunteer in China. His book is called The Last Days of Old Beijing, Life in the Vanishing Backstreets of a City Transformed. Michael, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Beijing has been preparing for this summer for years now. Can you talk a little bit about the city's process for transforming itself in order to host the Olympics?
Boy, where do I begin? It started in 1900. No, it's when the Olympics, Beijing had bid for the 2000 games that Sydney ended up hosting. And so this process of transformation actually began in 1990 and 1991. When the city decided that it was going to raise all of this dilapidated housing at the city core. And so that process has been going on since 91, and the government will admit to 500,000 people being evicted from the city center, which is equivalent to Washington, D.C.
Since the 90s.
Since the 90s, whereas other independent groups will say it's up to 1.25 million people have been evicted from the city center.
And what sort of notice and compensation do they get when their home is slated for destruction?
That's also changed. In the 1990s, you would have a character painted on your house. You'd wake up the next morning in your courtyard home and look out and see on your gray wall this big white character daubed, almost like a gang tag that says chai. It means raise. And then there would be a notice posted and would give you probably 2 to 3 weeks to get out. The government would assign you to a new apartment in the outlying suburbs where there weren't schools, where there weren't hospitals. In 2001, after Beijing won the Olympic bid, the process changed. The hand, as I call it in the book, this specter that comes in the night and still paints this white character on your wall that says raise, still comes around. But now you get compensation. They don't provide the apartment for you. Instead, you negotiate with the district government what sort of settlement they're going to have to give you to get you out of that house. Now, typically, these settlements start at 8,000 yuan, about 1,000 U.S. dollars a square meter. But the discrepancy is that since the Olympics were awarded to Beijing, inner-city land prices have skyrocketed because the Olympics have brought or heralded subway construction and better public transit in the city center. So residents, if they get this $1,000 per square meter, they can't afford to buy a house in their old community if one is built there. So they're pushed far out to the suburbs as well.
And what sort of cultural and social support is there for the people who, and I know there aren't many, who are holdouts?
They're the heroes of this book, I would say, because I admire the way that they go through this process. It can take 6 months to a year to exhaust legal channels. There isn't a lot of support, actually. Beijing has changed to the point politically now where as long as you're not organizing as a group, you can fight for your own personal rights. So often the propaganda that goes up in the neighborhoods will say things like, don't listen to rumors, you know, don't listen to what your neighbor is telling you about their settlement, let us deal with you one-on-one, because it's really a divide-and-conquer strategy. You also see propaganda that says things like, hand-in-hand, neighbors happily evacuate the neighborhood. So if your house has been marked for destruction, you're pretty much on your own, because lawyers in Beijing have been instructed not to take on resettlement cases, and lower courts will just reject them outright. So it's up to you to negotiate with the district government. And in the book, I tell stories of people who have done that and actually increased their compensation, in some cases, by twice as much as what was offered.
Yeah, can you describe a nail house for us, what that means?
A dingzohu in Chinese. A nail house refers both to the house itself and the stubbornness of the people inhabiting it, because China often says, you know, the nail that sticks out is the one that gets hammered down. So this case, I think nationwide consciousness of this case came to the fore in Chongqing, a southwestern city, where a married couple had a restaurant in an area that was being redeveloped for a shopping mall. They refused to move, and then listeners can just imagine, the excavators came and started digging this pit around this house until it was, you know, 60 feet in the air on this spike of land. And the couple, the husband's a martial arts champion, so he has a bit of a warrior streak in him, And his wife's a real firebrand, and she knew how to use the media. That's another thing that's changed in China. There's muckraking media now. They would refuse to move, and they flew a Chinese flag high, and they accepted food and water sent up to them by buckets, and they fought that thing in the court of public opinion until they also negotiated a very favorable the settlement they wanted to begin with.
Michael Meyer is my guest. His book is called The Last Days of Old Beijing, Life in the Vanishing Backstreets of a City Transformed. Will you talk about what the official line is comparing the old Beijing, the one that they're trying to change, with the sort of new and better one that, people are being promised is coming and has arrived for the Olympics?
Oh, boy. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Sichuan, in the province that was struck by the earthquake, and I was there from 1995 to 1997. I moved to Beijing in 1997, and I fell in love with it immediately. It reminded me so much of the Minnesota home that I grew up in because of the scale of the city, the climate. One thing that's interesting about the Hutong, I'll tell listeners, is that Beijing's Hutong, these lanes, are to Beijing what canals are to Venice. If people have been to Venice or seen Venice, it has that sort of a layout, a grid. In fact, Marco Polo, a Venetian, when he came to Beijing, he marveled at this symmetrical grid of streets that run north, south, east, west. And so when I moved to Beijing, I was struck by this beauty because they're built on a one-to-one ratio. The width of the lane is equal to the height of the houses. And so you have this very nestled feeling when you're in them, and the buildings are connected. There's no spaces between the buildings. So every lane, they're about 500 yards long, is really a small village, and they're often named for the products that were manufactured there. You have Jade Lane, for example, or Pineapple Lane, where they sold pineapple. So when I moved to Beijing, I was really struck by this beauty. And then over the years, I started noticing that I was being pushed farther and farther away from the center. I was living in an apartment. My neighbors weren't talking to me. And I was getting farther and farther away from the experience I had as a kid in Minnesota, and I also had as a Peace Corps volunteer. And so in 2005, I decided, well, this is kind of the last stand of this old Beijing, so I'm going to move into one of these neighborhoods and try to capture what's valuable about them, the daily interactions and how neighbors look out for one another.
We should say you moving into a hutong is something that just is not done by a foreigner and a Westerner who has the resources ostensibly to sort of live wherever you might have wanted.
The worst thing someone can attempt to do in China is set a precedent. And people maintain power or advance in the system by maintaining the status quo. You never want to take a risk that could backfire. So in order to move into this neighborhood, I had to convince not only the landlord of this courtyard home, which I shared with several families, but I had to convince the widow, this 80-year-old woman who would live there most of her life, that I would be a good neighbor. And I had to convince the police station that I was going to be an okay tenant, because this neighborhood is a half square mile, and there's 57,000 people that live there. It's one of the densest urban environments in the world. Vatican City is a half square mile, and it has 500 people in it. So I was setting a big precedent. And then to top it all off, I wanted to volunteer at the elementary school in the neighborhood, and that was unheard of because, you know, who would ever heard of a volunteer going into a school? I mean, Chinese used to laugh at me when I was in Peace Corps. They said, what kind of a nation sends its young people away from their families for 2 years to help strangers? And I had the same sort of reluctance when I moved into the neighborhood.
So how did you convince them that you were going to be a good neighbor?
It took time. With the widow, for example, she told me the first day that public is public, private is private. So as long as I adhered to those rules, she and I got on quite well. And she actually started feeling sorry for me quite quickly and started cooking for me. And the book opens at 7 a.m. with her walking into my house unannounced. And I'm in my boxer shorts, and she's smoking a Flying Horse cigarette. And she's telling me to eat, eat, eat. So she was the first one on board. The police were much harder. It wasn't until they needed help. They called me one day and they said, we need you to translate something for us. And they handed me the piece of paper. And in Chinese, it said, the legend of the Christmas stockings. And I said, what is this? And they said, oh, we want to send out Christmas cards this year in English. So could you help us translate this? So I did. But the winning volley with the police was, they have to learn English for the Olympics. And they study from a book called Olympic Security English. And it teaches you things like, excuse me, I'll have to detain you temporarily. You know, it has these drills about, will you please come with us?
Pretend to be innocent, isn't
don't
that
pretend
one of
to be innocent, exactly. And one guy, one officer, my local constable, came up to me one day and kind of embarrassed said, I want you to teach me every single English curse word. So I'll know if a foreigner is swearing at me. So he took me out for beers one night, and as the restaurant turned to stare. You know, I called him every name, like compared him to his mother and told him what to do with himself and everything else. So we became fast friends.
So as you mentioned, you had been in China for a couple of years, for some time, actually, mm-hmm. by the time you moved into the Hutong. But the privacy thing had to have been still an adjustment for you.
I didn't know if I should lock my door or put curtains up or set boundaries, and it just became quickly apparent that it was impossible for the simple reason that every morning the first thing we do in the Hutong is march in file down to the public latrine. And these are open-pit toilets. The one in my neighborhood, the one on my lane, doesn't have a divider. And so that's how the morning starts, you know. And then the second thing is we don't have a shower in our house, and so we go to the bathhouse, and those don't have dividers. So it was quickly apparent that those barriers were not going to work. My privacy, my tolerance of privacy was going to have to drop quite steadily.
You had a student at one point see you in the latrine and bow to you as the professor that you were.
Everybody calls me Teacher Plum Blossom, which is an endearment of my Chinese name. And so that's right. One of the first mornings is I'm in the bathroom doing my thing, and this kid runs in and pulls down his pants and then quickly sees me and stands up and says, "Good morning, Teacher Plum Blossom." That's the start of my day.
It doesn't strike me that you are this sort of person, but did it worry you at all that you, as a Westerner who knew that at any point you could get out of this situation, would have a tendency to sort of romanticize what is, at the end of the day, still a really sort of economically depressed lifestyle?
I am so glad you raised that point, because I was very aware of that from day one, that I had to be quite pragmatic. Because you're right, I could walk a few blocks away and get in a taxi and go to the Hyatt if I wanted to use a nice bathroom, for example, and walk right in because I'm a foreigner, and that carries some cachet in Beijing still. So I made very, you know, I was very sure in the book, especially, to talk about all the bad things about living in the Hutong and how hard it really is. And there's a reason people want to move out of them. I mean, some people, it's true that some people very much want to stay in those communities, but they want to stay because of the social network. An urban planner once walked through the lane with me, and he said, "Gosh, aside from open-heart surgery, everything you need is within a 15-minute walk of here." And that's really true. You know, for elderly residents, their doctor is there. For children, they know their teachers because the teachers often live in the neighborhood. Your market is there in the morning. People really look out for one another.
And so how do people deal with the poverty they experience? It seems like everyone is in sort of a similar situation. And so is it less apparent? Is it more apparent?
Well, Beijing's interesting right now because I don't think there's any really true poor people in our conception of it, in the inner city especially, because people often say neighborhoods like this. This neighborhood, by the way, is just south of Tiananmen Square. From my school windows, I can see Chairman Mao's mausoleum. I can see the Great Hall of the People, the Parliament. And the kids have no idea what those buildings are, but when I point at the McDonald's arches, they all scream, "McDonald's!" You know, they see that in the distance. But I don't think it's a slum. A slum is a place that causes pathological behavior in humans. This place is what I would call a stable, low-rent area, to recycle a phrase of Jane Jacobs. People are employed. They're migrants, mostly, that have come into Beijing and really want to buy into the Beijing dream. They want to become part of the status quo. They want to speak standard Mandarin instead of their dialect. They want to make a living. They're willing to pay taxes. They're willing to support the government. So in terms of poverty, people aren't for want of things. I mean, people have notebook computers. I have the internet in my house, believe it or not, although I don't have a toilet or plumbing. But there are consumer goods, and people are saving money there.
Michael Meyer is my guest. His book is called The Last Days of Old Beijing, Life in the Vanishing Backstreets of a City Transformed. We'd love for you to join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, creativity and curiosity, sharp. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris. Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with author Michael Meyer. His book is called The Last Days of Old Beijing, Life in the Vanishing Backstreets of a City Transformed. You can call us at 1-800-933-5372 to join the conversation, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Michael, it strikes me that the kind of complete transformation that's been undertaken in Beijing sounds like folly to us in some ways in the U.S. But in China, this is a place where there is a sort of cultural memory of enormous overhauls of everything that people knew.
Yeah, I was really surprised when I started doing the research that the book includes historical chapters of the many transformations of Beijing. And I was really surprised, even looking back to this movement in the 1915-1920 era, where United States-trained Chinese would come back to China and start remaking their cities by pulling down the city walls. You know, people who went to UCLA, for example, and came back. And Pearl Buck even wrote a short story about it in Nanjing, where she had lived, where she wrote most of her books, this transformation. So this cycle of old becoming new is something that Chinese cities are quite used to. And I think also European and American cities are used to this, too. We're kind of at the high point of it right now, where we're in a preservation mode rather than a building mode. But Moscow burned down 7 times and rebuilt. You know, London burned down and was rebuilt. Paris was redrawn. New York City pulled down most of its old housing or buildings in the 1920s to build skyscrapers. So it's all part of this pattern. I think in Beijing it's more pronounced because Beijing wasn't harmed during World War II. And so a lot of this old city was intact, which makes it heartbreaking for Westerners to see its erosion, because you say, oh, don't make the same mistakes that we did, to which Chinese engineers always say, we have every right to make the mistakes that you did.
Yeah, what is considered to be worthy of preservation?
That's been a big change since I first arrived in China in 1995. I do a lot of work with National Geographic Center for Sustainable Destinations, which is a project that helps train UNESCO World Heritage Site managers on preservation. And over the years, you know, a preservationist in China told me that China now is collecting UNESCO World Heritage Site certification the way actors pursue Oscars. Because once you have this certification, you can bring in tourists. And right now in China, everything is oriented towards self-sufficiency from the state. You know, make money, don't receive subsidies, as it were. And so in Beijing, the things that are valued now to be preserved are simply what you call the postcard sites. Before, they were denounced as relics of feudalism, so the Imperial Palace or old Buddhist temples or palatial gardens. But now those are places that you can put a gate up and charge admission and draw people in to showcase the city.
Michael Meyer is my guest. The book is called The Last Days of Old Beijing. Our number is 1-800-933-5372, and that is where we find Catherine in Dallas. Hi, Catherine.
Hi. I'm really interested in the show today. I actually moved to China in 1996 as a 10-year-old with my family and lived there for 8 years, and my parents are still there now. They're going on their 13th year. And what interests me is actually the idea that you were able to move into a hutong, which in the 90s would not have even been legal. And that's just, I guess, a sign of a lot of other changes. And I'd like you to speak, I guess, to how the relationship between foreigners living in Beijing and the Chinese people who live there, too, has changed over time. Now there's more communication, the media has changed, people speak more English. And I'd like to hear what your experience has been.
Thanks for your call.
Excellent question. That is a big change. And I think I was lucky in that I'm not a journalist. I think if you have a journalist visa in your passport, you're much more restricted to areas that you can live. I'm a mere teacher, which makes Chinese people, and especially Beijingers, kind of pity me because my salary is much lower than theirs. So, you know, again, the set the precedent thing, it's very difficult. But I speak Chinese. I'm very patient with the bureaucracy. And I realize, and so does people in the bureaucracy, that the bureaucracy hasn't quite caught up to the reality yet and what's happening in the streets of China. And so people were willing to help me, you know, register my home and approve my volunteering there. As to the question of the relations between locals and foreigners, I think that's changed quite a bit. Even I was just back in my former Peace Corps site right before the earthquake hit in Sichuan in May, and I was so surprised to see, you know, previously when I had lived there, I couldn't move 5 feet without someone yelling "Lao Wai," which means foreigner. And now, 12 years later, I was just so surprised at how people ignored me, which is kind of the greatest thing you can ask for in daily life, is to be ignored, you know, to go about your business on your own. That's really changed in China. People are becoming more acclimated.
Have you been back to the site of the earthquake at all since it happened, or is it really hard to? I know it's hard to travel there.
It's hard to travel there. I'm talking about setting precedents. I'm going to do a China book tour for the last days of old Beijing.
Wow!
And one of the cities I'm going to is Chengdu, which is near the epicenter. In August, I'll be back there, and I definitely plan on going back up to the area. I have friends who work in Wolong, the panda preserve, because I've done work down there, and I'm very eager to see what's happened to the panda center. And also the roadways, and also, of course, these communities that were just completely devastated.
I actually read, I'm curious about the response to the book in China. I read a book review of it on the China Digital Daily,
mm-hmm.
and they were sort of criticizing the fact that Westerners since the 20s have been decrying the end of the Hutong, and it hasn't happened yet, and what makes you think it's going to happen now? How different is the response that you get from Chinese people about what you have to say?
Well, in the book, I take note that it's true that Westerners since the 1920s have said, oh, here comes the end of old Beijing. But in the book, I also go back and look at what Chinese writers were saying at the same time. So if you have a foreigner living in a palatial courtyard saying, oh, old China, it's so lovely, what was the contemporary Chinese person saying? Well, what they were saying in the 1920s was, this place is backward, desiccated, drab. I dream of wide roads. I dream of Paris. And that goes all throughout the book. I parallel how Westerners view the old capital and how Chinese actually talk about it. Right now in Beijing, there are quite a few muckraking journalists and preservationists, and I talk about these people in the book, I follow them around, who are advocating the preservation of the old city, and it's been a huge change. It's sort of chic now to preserve things.
You talk about other great cities that have been rebuilt either by choice or by necessity, and of course the best example of this is Paris that was completely redone. There is, as you point out, no Haussmann working in Beijing right now.
No, and that's a very difficult thing for preservationists because most preservation movements are citizen oriented and they start in opposition to government plans. In Beijing, that's simply impossible. The land is still held by the state. City financing in China is quite different than in the West. There are no municipal referendums. There are no municipal bonds. You know, Haussmann, what he did with Paris in the 19th century, he was the first developer to use deficit financing to actually finance the projects he wanted to do. In China, they don't have that. Here, if you want to change your city, you can expect city council meetings, and I'm sure listeners have been up against their city council or dealt with zoning issues before. In China, there isn't that outlet, and so there's no transparency. And that's really, when residents talk about having to move out of their houses or when preservationists talk about what's difficult right now in China, it's not an issue of money, it's transparency. It's knowing, well, who do you talk to? You know, where do I target my resources to try to convince someone to save this area?
Can't the Hutongs survive if they are becoming more and more sort of geographically isolated? Does that culture require a preponderance of other Hutongs to really thrive?
No, because, like I said, everyone is a village. I live on Red Bayberry and Bamboo Slanted Street, which is beautifully named, but it's named for apothecaries that used to sell Red Bayberry there, and also bamboo, which artisans used to carve bamboo whistles to put on the end of pinion feathers, so they make these noises overhead when they fly. Now, I live on that street, and everybody on that street knows me. If I go to the next lane, people look at me like I'm a stranger. It's very, very different. And there's been so many times, I document this in the book, where I'll go for a walk at night, and I'll walk four or five lanes away, and it'll be rubble. And you think, well, how did this just happen? And it's because you can't hear a sledgehammer over a few lanes away. And so in our neighborhood, I've watched over the past 3 years as Walmart has come onto the edges. You know, McDonald's was already there. Now we're getting a Starbucks and a Pizza Hut. And it's nibbling away at the edges, but that core element still survives, and it can still survive. And people are Beijingers are amazingly fluid. People like Walmart. It's air-conditioned, for one. So you walk in there, and Beijing summers are, I imagine, like West Texas summers are. It's sweltering hot, and sometimes you'll walk in there on a summer day, and it's like a bee-in. You just see all these grandmothers standing still in the aisle, you know, enjoying the air conditioning. So.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. You write, increasingly, whenever I left the Hutong, I missed Beijing. Not its tangible architecture, but the intangible lifestyle that navigated and lived within it. Can you talk about what really has changed in addition to the architecture over the past few years?
I think the biggest thing that's changed in Beijing is that it's become lonelier. And if people have lived in old China, if they've lived in Beijing in the 90s even, they'll know what I'm talking about. And what I mean is that with the addition of cars instead of bicycles, so we say 1,000 new drivers on the street every day. It sounds like a lot, but again, it's 365,000 new cars a year. You're starting from zero. There are a lot of cars, but there's still more bicycles and pedestrians in Beijing. But when you have these wide roads that don't encourage sidewalk interactions with people, when you have cars that are constantly honking at you, I mean, imagine 1,000 new drivers a day on the street. When you have people, this widening rift between rich and the poor, Beijingers don't divide themselves by what job you do or what part of the country you're from. They divide, or what high school they went to even. They really divide, am I a local or am I an outsider, a migrant? And so there's this real antagonism between locals and migrants as migrants come in and do service jobs that locals won't do. It's tangible in Beijing. And one thing I love about living in the Hutong is that there's civility there. People can't curse at each other without there being consequences. You can't rob somebody without there being consequences because all eyes are on the street at all times and people really look out for one another.
Did you feel a pressure to look out for people even when it wasn't convenient for you and when it wasn't anything like what your American culture that you were raised with would have obligated you to?
Well, China kind of teaches you when to be part of the crowd and when to step forward. Mm-hmm. And sometimes as a foreigner, you have to be careful at those moments you choose to step forward. There was a fight on our street one night, and I went out and I got in between the two people. And then they both turned on me. Like, oh, you foreigner, what are you, I teach a foreign blood, this isn't your business. And they went at it with each other. It was really funny. It was a moment of like, oops. But there's been other times when I've seen things on the street and simply, I know on the street who's the elder, who's the guy or who's the older woman that I can go and say, hey, Auntie Yang, can you go check out what those kids are doing? You know what I mean? And then they kind of police themselves.
How long do you expect that you'll stay there?
Well, I don't want to ruin the ending of the book. You got to keep going. But the book ends, and there's no doubt what happens at the book's conclusion. But I'll be back for the games, and I'll stay in the neighborhood. But I don't think I'm revealing too much by saying that posters did go up in April. The hand came through and said it's time for the neighborhood to be redeveloped.
Yeah, and you're not revealing too much because it's a fascinating story regardless, but that exceptionally emotional time for you.
It will be, and I have no plans, just like my neighbors or everybody else in the neighborhood. It's funny because for the last 3 years, everybody's been drilled in Olympic etiquette. I teach Olympic English at the elementary school. I teach Olympic welcome English at the old folks' retirement center. Everybody's so geared up for the games and what it's going to mean for Beijing. But then when you ask people in my neighborhood, are you going? No. I mean, tickets are very expensive. You need a Visa card to enter the lottery, or you needed a bank account at Bank of China. People don't have that. So I plan on spending the time of the games on the alley. Someone will bring a TV outside. You know, we'll sit and watch the events during the day with beers.
You know, language things are always interesting, and they can cause a lot of funny things. As someone who is teaching English, I guess there's a prescribed set of phrases that the government would like you to to give to your students, and then there must be times when you tell them, no, don't say that to an English speaker, say this.
Well, the kids in Beijing study from a text that's led by a monkey named Maki. Now, I don't know who thought of the idea of having your character be making fun of the people who are studying, but his name is Maki, and he sounds like Truman Capote on helium. I mean, he's almost unintelligible. And there's DVDs the kids are supposed to follow, and they read the subtitles, and I have to confess, so do I. So we deal with Maki, and, you know, it's funny, in Beijing, in China, actually, there's no proficiency levels. And so it's not like in the States, if you study Spanish or French, where there's Spanish 1 or French 3 or whatnot. Everybody gets lumped into the same textbook. So the best students and the worst students sort of slide to this middle. And a lot of the vocabulary in the book has no relation to kids' daily lives, which you really want to have when you're teaching a foreign language. You know, Maki wants to be a veterinarian or he wants to be a nurse. But when I ask the kids, well, what do you want to be when you grow up? The first kid yelled, I want to be a foreigner. And the second person said, you know, well, my father's unemployed. How do I say that? Another person said, well, my mom's a hairdresser. And so we went down this whole list and we came up with fried food cook and road repairman and on what the kids families do for a living rather than what Maki would have them be doing.
Yeah, and do you get the sense that the folks in Beijing that are preparing the citizens for this onslaught of tourists from all over the world really understand what's coming to them?
I hope there is an onslaught of tourists from around the world. There's been such tightening of visa restrictions and other complications. It's harder for people to come to Beijing for security concerns in August. I don't think they know. I think they're incredibly excited. People, you know, Beijingers are curmudgeons. They're like New Yorkers times 10, really. I mean, they'll complain about anything. It's like the old Woody Allen joke about, you know, these two women are at a resort, and one says, oh, the food here is terrible. And the other woman says, and such small portions. And that's Beijing in a nutshell, I think. So people are, although they're complaining about, oh, the road construction and the dust and stuff, the Olympics are actually good for the city. It's propelled a lot of public transportation, construction, for example, a lot of addition of green space. And people are very excited. Beijingers, I should say, really want the world to come and see their city and welcome foreigners.
We're hearing now a lot about this slime problem. Is it in Qingdao? Is that where
yes,
it is?
At the yachting venue.
Are they getting a handle on that?
I have no idea. I hope so. That's the funny thing about China. You know, it's remember the build-up to the Athens game, the games where the pressure was, can they get the stadiums done? Can everything get done? Whereas in Beijing and the other venues, the International Olympic Committee actually told Chinese organizers, slow down, because the venues were completed so far ahead of time. They said it's going to take too much money to, you know, clean them and keep them in shape. So the venues are all set. And now, like you said, the real challenges right now are, A, that slime that's in the bay of Qingdao, where the yachting is going to be held. And they have people on the scene with nets. I'm sure they'll get it cleaned up. But in Beijing, the real challenge right now is to clean up the air quality before the games start.
Yeah, and that has been a challenge that so far they haven't been able to get much of a handle on. Is that right?
Yeah, and it's one of those things that I've seen so many. The book does talk about all the positive things that have happened in Beijing in the last 10 years as far as infrastructure and the environment. You know, really moving factories out of the city center. Chairman Mao wanted to see an ocean of smokestacks from the skyline of Tiananmen Square, and that happened. And now those have all been moved out of the city, and air quality markedly improved. But then you're adding these cars onto the streets every day. They're not pickup trucks or SUVs, mind you, but they're not incredibly energy efficient either.
Michael Meyer is my guest. His book is called The Last Days of Old Beijing, Life in the Vanishing Backstreets of a City Transformed. We'll return to our conversation in a moment. You're welcome to join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, creativity and curiosity, sharp. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is author Michael Meyer. His new book is called The Last Days of Old Beijing, Life in the Vanishing Backstreets of a City Transformed. You seem to have, Michael, a great sense of humor about the people that you've met. You're very fond of them, obviously. Sometimes when you describe the conversations that you've had with them or that you've observed, people there are exceptionally blunt. Did you find yourself, because, you know, they'll say to each other, well, no wonder you're so fat, or
oh, yeah.
The widow would call you a moron and you would sort of just laugh it off. Did you find yourself communicating in the same way?
Yeah, and it's really difficult when I return to the United States because I went to the University of Wisconsin-Madison from 1990 to 1995 at the height of political correctness. And so ever since I've been in China, you just, you know, it's like, you're always taking these shots like a boxer because people will just walk up to you and say, boy, you've gained a lot of weight, or, oh, your hair is really thinning, or that shirt sure is ugly. And if you talk about, like, how much you paid for something, you expect, if you say, well, I paid $10 for it, they're going to shoot back, oh, I could have got it for $8. And it goes back and forth, these mock insults. And Beijingers are amazing with their swear words, you know, these inventive things they call each other. So it definitely thickens your skin. I enjoy it a lot, actually.
When you go back home, I'm curious about the things that people ask you about and want to know about, and then the things that you'd love to tell them but nobody ever brings up.
When I'm in the States, you know, it's fun. I think Chinese and American, I think the reason I don't feel so out of place living in China is that I think Chinese and Americans have, at their root, something very much in common, and that's a self-effacing sense of humor. Ours is probably best exemplified in Mark Twain. They have an equivalent humorist from that era. So it's easy there to laugh at yourself. And I mean, that's something that doesn't come through in the States when you're a journalist or you're reading journalistic accounts, because obviously it's very serious topics. There's a lot of stuff going on in China that matters and people should be concerned about. And so when I come home, I'm always trying to convey that At the end of the day, these people want security and happiness for their families, and they don't take themselves so seriously, it would, you know, portrayed in the media. What's hard is when I come home, a lot of people, they hear the word China, and so I get asked questions about Tibet or Falun Gong or Taiwan, or you just name these raft of issues that that occur. And then B, I always say, look, if a Chinese person had lived in America, let's say, for 10 years and went back to China, and then everybody there said, come on, come in the media, could you tell us all about Guantanamo? Could you tell us about Iraq? And all these issues, I think that person would probably say, no, I can give you my opinion, but I can't give you a definitive answer.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Peter in Grapevine. Hi, Peter.
Hey, how are you doing?
Great, thanks.
Listen, I'm also a badger.
All right.
But I graduated in 72. And so I was a little bit older in 89 when how many people in Tiananmen Square and their bodies buried in mass graves and the families never found out where they were? I mean, has anybody ever... have they faced that in Beijing these days? I mean, everybody's feel good, but essentially they did a mass murder and got away with it.
It's a topic that people who were in Beijing in 1989, especially that generation, talk about at length. You don't need to prod people to talk about it. Younger generation, you know, kids I teach in school, it's very patriotic. I think like any education system, it's never raised at all. One of the things the generation that went through 1989 and the protests at Tiananmen Square and all around China, it wasn't just in Beijing, one of the things they all say is that, well, we've won. Not win in terms of a reckoning, which I'll talk about in a second, but that their demands have largely been met. Or not met, but at least life has improved, that, you know, there's more personal freedoms, there's more freedom to move around the country where you want to make a living. The economics certainly are part of it. There's much more choices. You can travel abroad or study abroad. Corruption is, the party makes a big show or a big attempt. I shouldn't say a show. They make an attempt to root out corruption at different levels. There is a woman named Ding Zilin who is a mother of one of the victims of Tiananmen, and she still campaigns for a reckoning. You know, she every year at the anniversary, she still gives interviews and talks about one day, you know, there will be an official accounting of what happened there. But the official government line has not changed at all.
How political are, what percentage of conversations in the Hutong are political?
Oh, you know, it's like here, it's like asking how much oxygen do we breathe? It's people never bring it up. They'll ask me about Obama. They'll ask me about Bush. They call him Little Bush because he's Bush Jr. That's his name in Chinese, Michelle Boucher, Little Bush. They'll ask me about Iraq. And often, surprisingly enough, a lot of people will say, you know, it's America, of course, it's in Iraq. When China was a mighty, if China were a mighty power, it would do those things too. As far as daily life with Chinese politics, it very rarely comes up, believe it or not. It's just people are going about their day-to-day existence and trying to make a living.
How much time do they spend talking about their pigeons?
If you have pigeons, unfortunately, it's about 90% of your time. One of my students' fathers has a pigeon coop on his roof. It's a Hutong hobby to keep pigeons. And whenever I go over there, we go up to his roof and look at the pigeons in the coop. And the whole time, as he's bragging about his pigeons and how beautiful they are and the races he's entering them in, you hear his wife's voice down below in the courtyard yelling, you know, those pigeons, they keep using the bathroom on my laundry that's drying, and those pigeons are going to give us avian flu, and that's not a hobby, and she rails against it. But, yeah, if you're a pigeon enthusiast, it's all you talk about.
Did you try this at any point?
A pigeon? No. No.
And you were willing to watch other people engage in the hobby.
Yeah, exactly. Nor did I have a dog, which was a rising obsession in the lanes. As people got more and more disposable income, they too wanted little yapping Pekingese. So in the morning, my morning walk to the public latrine became more and more troublesome as the years went by, yapping at my ankles.
You mentioned that you had, you know, internet access in the place where you were living, but you did not have, you know, you don't have plumbing. I'm wondering if theft was an issue.
I'm sorry, if theft?
Yeah, if you had to
when
be careful.
When I first moved in, the police, the rationale for not having me there, which perhaps, I think it was so I wouldn't cause them trouble, but it was that it's not safe and there's going to be things stolen from you and whatnot. I'd lived in Beijing, you know, probably 6 years prior to this in apartments. I've had 4 bikes stolen in that time. I've had personal effects stolen from restaurants. when I was in Peace Corps, I was attacked on a bus. I mean, just horrible things. Pickpocketed, the whole thing. In the Hutong, since I lived there, not one single incident has occurred to me. I leave my bike outside every day. My room in this courtyard is very simple, but I keep my computer in there. Nothing's ever been taken. And the reason for this, I think, is that there's just eyes on the street all the time. In 2 years in the neighborhood, there was one murder. A painter was strangled by three men, and they caught them within 2 days in an outlying suburb. And the way they caught them was that daisy chain of asking aunties, did you see anybody? And, you know, following those descriptions all the way back until they caught the men.
Aunties meaning sort of elderly women that are in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you talk about, once the Olympics are over, what you think Beijing will look like and the extent to which progress will continue or abate?
I think it's funny. I'd rather see it after the games than during the games. And I'm looking forward to, say, September, when all the people are gone and you can use the public transportation systems. Really, Beijing used to just have a very rudimentary subway system, a skeletal subway system that didn't really get you to where you needed to go. It was a loop line, and it was a straight line across. It wasn't like New York or Paris or London's metro or tube where you zigzagged across the city. That's being built due to the Olympics, so that's going to be a big benefit. As far as the venues and stuff, that's a big question, is what's going to happen with them. I should note that none of the Olympic venues are being built inside the old city. So nothing's been torn down to make way for, say, the Bird's Nest or the Water Cube, these inventive stadiums that are going up. Those are out in the northern suburbs.
They really are some amazing places, the Bird's Nest in particular. Can you describe it?
Picture a bird's nest only made of ribbons of steel.
Yeah.
You know, it's this incredible design of lattice steel around the shell. And I actually, last year, 2007, a year before the games were going to begin, I just went out there. I took a cab, and I walked right into the building site, and all the workers said hi, and I kept walking. And I walked right into the stadium itself and climbed up the rafters to where 90,000 people are going to be filling, and I could sit in the very topmost row and just watch them build this thing, and no one obstructed me. It was fantastic.
Is there any criticism whatsoever of the amount of money being spent on all of this construction in a place where, as you mentioned, the government is working hard to get people self-sufficient and off the aid that they've become accustomed to?
Yes. I mean, the bill right now is estimated at $40 billion. I talked to somebody who was involved with New York's bid for the Olympics, where they were talking about their budget was going to be $2.5 billion because all that infrastructure was already in place. So it's definitely an issue in China. There are critics that speak in the media. The media is more and more open now, especially with blogging and the internet and cell phone communication, that $40 billion, you know, is this price tag really worth it when there's so many areas of China that are still very, very poor? I mean, I think that's the other thing I hope people realize, is that although we hear these stories about shiny Beijing and shiny Shanghai, and they're very sexy images that are coming out of there, most of the Chinese population, a vast majority, still lives in the countryside and still works as farmers. Something China wants to change in the coming years. But there are critics that say, yes, we could have used that differently.
As you mentioned, there is a lot of resistance to people who sort of immigrate from the country into the cities to work, and they're looked down upon. What does it take for a rural Chinese person to become accepted and sort of part of the social fabric of a city like Beijing?
I follow a family in the book, a soldier in the People's Liberation Army, and his parents who immigrate from central China to Beijing. And I watched their shop get destroyed, and I think, okay, well, that's the end of their story. They're going to go home. But they stuck around, and they stayed in the city, and they kept working, and they got a better noodle shop. And one day I asked them, like, why do you stay here? I don't understand. They said, well, go visit our home where we're from. And so I traveled overnight to the center of China, to these lowest plains. And when you see the villages that migrants come from, it's very obvious why you would want to come to Beijing. It's cleaner, it's better access to technology, it's better access to different kinds of people, and of course money. And so I've watched this family, when they first came into the neighborhood, you know, people were really kind of skeptical of them. And now a year later, I mean, she's the auntie of the neighborhood. It's like their restaurant is more successful than the one that was torn down. They're happy the other one was torn down now. She's become this fixture of this hive of activity in the neighborhood, and not just for other migrants in the neighborhood, but local Beijingers really like going there. Tourists go there. And I think it just comes down to, if you aren't passing through, if you settle, if you offer services, if you're a go-to person, and if you're making money and hiring other people in the area, then people accept you. It's the same anywhere in the world, I think.
You were able to move into a Hutong because you do not have a journalist visa. Mm-hmm. Now that you've published a book, and as you mentioned, you're going on a Chinese book tour, do you think you're going to be watched a little more carefully?
Perhaps, but I don't know if I could be watched any more carefully than I was when I was in. When I was in Peace Corps, we couldn't even be called Peace Corps. It was called the U.S.-China Friendship Volunteers because Peace Corps had been slandered by Mao throughout the 60s as a CIA front. So I was very much watched there, and of course I've been very watched in Beijing. And I think at the end of the day, there's nothing in the book that I wouldn't defend. I mean, I'm very honest to the people I'm writing about, there's nothing in there that I would say looks down upon China. It's factual reporting. There's an enormous bibliography in the back. There are sources. I source every single fact in the book, and a lot of those sources are Chinese sources, which is unique for a Western book about China.
Michael, with all these changes, will Beijing still be Beijing? Do you have to find a way to accept that it's still the place you love? It just has had a drastic makeover?
Yeah, I think Beijing will always be Beijing. And I think, you know, everybody has a different take on a city. You have your Dallas and I have my Miami or whatnot. Everybody has their city, their view of a city based on the time they were there and also the point of life they were in. I don't have a child yet, for example. If I were raising a child in Beijing, I'd probably look at it quite differently. I spent my bachelor years, you know, in Beijing. It was very fun, a type of economic bubble. So you can imagine, I mean, that was a very different experience than someone who's middle-aged would have had. I think Beijing eventually will be like European cities. There'll be a historic sort of medieval core at its center, ringed by more and more modernity. And that's okay. When I went into the neighborhood, I thought, maybe I'll write a book about old architecture. But the title, The Last Days of Old Beijing, really doesn't refer to the destruction of this old architecture. It refers to this densely knit community and way of life that, frankly, Beijing could be a poster city for for sustainable communities the world over.
And are people finding new ways to connect even after their neighborhoods are sort of torn?
No, and that's a sad thing. When people are moved out, those bonds really fray. And, you know, again, they quickly reform. I think it's true of China or any city. When you see new buildings going in, the first reaction is to say, oh, yuck, it's arid, it's barren, it's not as good as it was before. But if you revisit these places 2 or 3 years later, you find that life finds a way. You know, life wins out. Stores do open. Restaurants do open. New networks do form. And I think in these outlying communities in Beijing, as long as public transport's being provided back into the city, as long as there's facilities like hospitals and schools and supermarkets, as long as the lower middle class can still be entrepreneurs and open their shops, new communities will form there, too. You just gave me an idea for a sequel. That's great.
Excellent. Michael Meyer is a former Peace Corps volunteer in China. His book is called The Last Days of Old Beijing, Life in the Vanishing Backstreets of a City Transformed. Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
I really appreciate it, Chris. Thank you.
And when you write that sequel, give us a call again.
Great.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.